All right, good morning. We are going to be tackling a little bit more of the subject of the Bible and what it has to say about the virgin birth, and specifically, we're going to look at Isaiah 7 and verse 14 today and its surrounding context. So you want to be in Isaiah 7:14. I want to talk about some challenges to the doctrine and the teaching of the Bible regarding the virgin birth. And Isaiah 7:14 is one of those texts that people focus on a great deal. So I want to talk about ultimately two challenges when we come to the virgin birth and the prophecy given in Isaiah 7 and verse 14. Now I'm going to read Isaiah 7 and verse 14. And remember, this is the text that the angel in Matthew's gospel quotes to Joseph before Joseph deals with the fact that Mary had been found with child. And we read this in Isaiah 7:14. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Emmanuel. There are two large challenges to this teaching that comes from Isaiah 7:14. And I want to note those, and then we'll kind of try to deal with them. The first is that there is a debate as to what the term virgin means. Now, you know, not trying to be crass or crude, but, you know, we hear that term and we just think, well, we know what that means, right? But, of course, the underlying Hebrew word that is used here has been a challenge. The suggestion is that Matthew misused or creatively adapted, which is another way of saying misused, misused or creatively adapted the Isaiah prophecy and applied it to Jesus. And we'll talk about that, why people have suggested this. Ultimately, this is an attack against the authority of the Bible by some who have suggested that the Bible is not really talking about an actual virgin in the sense that we typically use that word. That in the original context of Isaiah, Isaiah was not thinking about a miracle here. And so when Matthew uses it and applies it to Jesus, that Matthew is in some sense either misusing or, as I say, they're creatively adapting this Isaiah prophecy. Now, you say, why would we talk about this? I'm going to name a group of people who claim to speak as Christians, largely are not. I mentioned this in a sermon about 5 years ago around Christmas time. So if you've heard this before, I apologize. If you've not, you know, here it is for you. If you heard it before and forgot, shame on you. Not really. That's a long time ago. But there's a group of people who claim to be Christians around here. They're the one of the largest groups of so-called Christians in Minnesota and the upper Midwest area, and that is of the ELCA Lutherans, Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. If you were to go today to an ELCA seminary, you would be hard-pressed to find a single teacher there who actually believes that Jesus was literally born of a virgin in the sense that we use that term. In fact, I think there are very few ELCA pastors who would believe that Jesus was actually born from a virgin. They will quote the creeds, but what they will do is not tell their people that they don't really believe it, or they just redefine what that means. Even today, if you go to the ELCA's website, you'll be hard-pressed to find any statement whatsoever about the virgin birth of Christ other than maybe quoted in a creed. But back in 2010, they released a statement about their church's teaching on the virgin birth because they had church members and people saying, you know, I think we've got pastors and we've got teachers who don't actually believe in the literal virgin birth of Christ. They took it down. But originally, it was under their, quote, digging deeper section, and this was the official teaching of the ELCA church. It was given as a help to people in their church to better understand the Bible and the doctrine of the Bible. And after talking about the history of the doctrine, I want you to listen to the conclusion they gave. Again, you cannot find this now. They took it down because they took so much flack from people who were very upset. It says, quote, when we confess in the Apostles' Creed that Jesus was conceived by the power and the Holy Spirit and born of the Virgin Mary, And when we confess in the Nicene Creed that Jesus is, quote, the only Son of God and eternally begotten of the Father, we are not making a gynecological assertion. We are saying that God entered into Christ and in him is fully revealed to humankind. This is God's graceful act of reconciliation with creation and humankind's redemption. Did you hear what they said there? He said, we're not doctors. We don't know what really happened. We're just saying that God entered into Christ. Now, the crazy thing about that is that language is actually an ancient Christological doctrine of Christ heresy that says that the Spirit or the Christ Spirit came upon Jesus, the man, at some point. That's an old heresy that they actually just blurted out on their statement online. So here's what they're saying. We'll talk about the virgin birth, but we don't actually know what that means. And if you don't think that that's really what they're saying, listen to what they go on to say. Quote, in the final analysis, it matters little whether St. Paul knew of or believed in the doctrine of the virgin birth. I say that clearly. So as clear as you could be, this is not important. Okay, now you say, how do they get there? Well, we're going to explain, because this Isaiah 7:14 text is one of them, and they're going to suggest that the term virgin doesn't really mean virgin in the way that we use that term. Second, there's a question of how the virgin birth prophecy could be fulfilled by Jesus, since the context of Isaiah 7 seems to indicate that there is some sort of an immediate fulfillment during the time of Ahaz, who originally receives the prophecy. And I know that's a mouthful of a sentence, but here's what that means. Immediate fulfillment, your blanks there. Here's what that means practically. Some people have suggested that, and it looks like, that in Isaiah 7, that prophecy should be immediately experienced by Isaiah. And if you look in the context, it feels that way. And so therefore, we wonder, how does this actually apply to Jesus? If it was experienced back in Isaiah 7's day, how does that actually apply to Jesus? So those are two challenges to the doctrine, the teaching of the virgin birth. All right? So let's first of all, as we try to unpack and try to deal with these challenges, the question of what does this term virgin mean and how does this apply to Jesus if it originally appears or may have been fulfilled during the time of Ahaz, how in the world do we deal with these things? Well, let's start with just a little bit of the context of Isaiah 7. And I hope you got your Bibles open. We're just going to look at the first few verses here of Isaiah 7. When Isaiah penned these words, there's a wicked king on the throne of David in Jerusalem. That's the capital in Judah. And his name was Ahaz. Ahaz was a wicked king who refused to heed the word of the Lord. And Ahaz and the people of Judah ran into a problem. And that problem is seen in chapter 7 and verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up to Jerusalem to make war against it, but could not prevail against it. All right, so here's the historical problem. Ahaz is king in Judah, and you have the king of Israel. Remember, this is the divided kingdom era, northern kingdom of Israel, southern kingdom of Judah, tag teaming with the king of Syria, Rezin, and they've decided they want to go and attack Judah and take it over. All right, so the northern kingdom's teamed up with Syria, and they try to take the city of Jerusalem, and they couldn't do it. But still, this is a problem. I mean, if you're getting right up to the city, that means the surrounding area is decimated. This is a bad deal. And then we read this in verse 2. And it was told to the house of David, that is the king's household in Jerusalem, saying, Syria's forces are deployed in Ephraim. Now, Ephraim is the tribe just to the north of Jerusalem. This is right on their doorstep. We're talking within miles of their border. So they've just finished a long battle and a long siege, and now here comes round two, right? So put it in modern parlance, whatever you think about the whole Ukraine-Russia situation, right? We have Russia just keep putting body blow after body blow after body blow at Ukraine, and at some point you start to wonder, can we hold? Which is where we're at in the world right now, okay? So this is this kind of thing happening. And apparently, Ahaz knew that he and the people were likely not going to be able to withstand this attack, because you see this at the end of verse 2, his response. So his heart and the heart of his people were moved as the trees of the woods are moved in the wind. You know, just the other day, we had that wicked wind that was just whipping through here, you know, and you're just watching everything doing that. So there's no stability here, right? They're terrified. Okay? But God responds in verse 3. He sent Isaiah and his son to go meet Ahaz, and here was his message in verse number 4. Take heed and be quiet. Do not fear or be faint-hearted, for these two stubs of smoking firebrands. I just love that imagery. It's like they're burnt-out charred sticks. They're not going to do anything. You're worried about nothing. This is how they describe the king of Syria and the king of Israel. Don't worry about them. They're no better than a burnt out piece of wood. There's nothing there. And so God says through Isaiah clearly in verse 7 about their plans to attack. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, nor shall it come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. Within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken, so that it will not be a people. The head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. And here's what Isaiah is saying here. These are all the plans of men. They're formed by men, and they're put in place by men, but God's plans are different. It will not come to pass. They are not going to break you. They're not going to get you. It will not happen. Now, this was God's message to Ahaz to say, don't worry about what men can do. Trust in me. I mean, that's a sermon right there, right? It's just a great text. But there's a catch, and you see it at the end of verse 9. If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. Now, here the you is not talking about the whole city of Jerusalem. It's talking about you, Ahaz. You will not be established. No matter what, the plans of Syria and Israel are going to fall. That was assured. But if Ahaz and Judah would trust God and follow him, the plans of Syria and Israel would fail, and Judah would be blessed, and Ahaz would be blessed. If they would not trust God, they would ultimately be destroyed. Now, God, through Isaiah, gives Ahaz the chance of a lifetime in verses 10 through 11. I mean, you just think about, put yourself in his shoes. I hope I would take this chance if an actual prophet of the Lord came to me and said, moreover, the Lord spoke again to Ahaz, saying, ask a sign for yourself from the Lord your God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. So God says, this is through the prophet Isaiah, you can ask me for anything to prove this is true. I will show you a miracle of any kind on the earth or in the heavens. You ask whatever you want, and I will do it so that you will know and believe that what God says is true. You know, people talk about, you know, seeing is believing, or if I could just see, or if God just pulled back the curtain from heavens and I could see him for a minute, then I would believe. Isaiah offers that under the authority of God to Ahaz. And here's Ahaz's chance. But notice Ahaz's response. I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. Now that may sound really pious, but it was in fact evil. Ahaz has no interest in actually trusting the Lord. He could have had God, you know, brought up a massive tornado or a thunderstorm or literally make it rain gold coins from the sky. He could have done whatever he wanted. And he doesn't do that. Now, why does Ahaz not do that? Because Ahaz, at this point already, has demonstrated that he is an abundantly wicked king that has no interest whatsoever in actually obeying the Lord. And if you want an example of that, we don't have time to develop it, but you can turn to 2 Kings 16 on your own time, and you will find his utter disdain for the Lord. Ahaz actually took, ironically, the foreign altar of the Syrian king that he had defeated in battle and decided to put that in the temple and use that as the place to worship God and offer sacrifices on, which is just stupid on so many levels, right? You know, you just beat these guys, so let's take their false god's worship item and stick it in our temple and say, let's worship God through that. This just shows his utter disdain for the Lord. You can read about Ahaz elsewhere in the rest of the Bible. He's one of the worst kings that Judah has. Now, so when he says, I will not test the Lord, I'm not going to tempt the Lord, this is pure hypocrisy. He has no interest in believing God. Now, the rest of Isaiah 7 and 8 is God's pronouncement of judgment on Ahaz and Judah because they did not trust the Lord. And God promised Ahaz and the people of Judah that they would ultimately be harmed by the Assyrians in the end and not helped. And in fact, if you read in 2 Chronicles 28, this happens in Ahaz's lifetime. He had to keep emptying out the treasury to try to pay off the Assyrian king. Instead of just trusting that the Lord would defend him, he tries to buy his way into favor with foreign kings. And eventually that did not work, and Assyria took over Judah and make Ahaz's followers, that is the people that came after him, puppet kings, and most of Judah its own provinces. That's kind of the longer history there. Now, in addition, while the people of Judah and Ahaz turned to the Assyrians for help, they didn't help them that much. In 2 Chronicles 28, it records that when the Assyrians helped to defend Jerusalem, the rest of Judah was left to slaughter. Literally, 2 Kings 28:6 records that Pekah, king of Israel, killed 120,000 men in one day in Judah. So they kept the city of Jerusalem and watched the countrysides burn. And to give perspective on that, that is almost 2.5 times larger than the 3 days of Gettysburg. So Ahaz had a chance to simply trust the Lord, and he refused. Now, that summary for our question is important because the prophecy of Isaiah 7:14 occurs in the midst of a specific context of Ahaz and his opportunity to receive a sign from God to prove that God would keep his word. When Ahaz does not ask for a sign, God gives him a sign anyway in verse number 14. And our immediate thought is that Ahaz would receive the sign of the child born during his lifetime. It feels like it should read that way. So if that's the case, how could this actually be fulfilled by Jesus? And furthermore, many people will point out that in Isaiah 8 in verses 1 through 3, you have there a reference to Isaiah going into his wife, the prophetess. She conceives and bears a son. And some people say that that is the near fulfillment of the promise that was given to Ahaz. All right, so there's some challenges here. How does this actually apply to Jesus? If Ahaz would expect that the prophecy would be fulfilled in his lifetime, in what sense was the woman who was going to conceive be considered a virgin? Okay, so there's some challenges here. Okay, so that's the context. How do we deal with that? Well, first of all, let's think about the term here that's used. It's translated as virgin. I've given you the Hebrew term. The term there is alma. The term does not always mean always virgin in the sense that we use the term. As I mentioned, this has led some critics of the Bible to suggest that the idea of virgin does not mean some sort of miracle here. And you can just think about it this way, that, you know, the fact that someone was a virgin and then conceived doesn't imply any sort of miraculous act. And that's how some people would see this. So the term does not always mean virgin in the way that we use it. However, this word is used 7 times in the Old Testament in a context of a woman. They seem in each case to be referring to a physically mature young woman who is unmarried, assumed to be chaste, that is, a virgin. So to put the matter bluntly, there is a specific term that can refer to what we would think as defined of as a virgin. There's another term, and that's the one here, that means it's an unmarried person. They're physically mature. They're able to conceive. But it doesn't necessarily mean an actual physical virgin in the way that we would typically use that word. However, when you look in the Old Testament, when this term is used in context of a woman, it in every case, with the exception of possibly one, does appear to be used as we would use the term virgin. And the one exception, I think, is Proverbs 30 and verse 9. And even there, you can read it in the way that we would understand typically a word, the word as virgin. So the term can clearly refer to someone who is chaste and thus a virgin, and that would be the natural reading of the term. But liberal skeptics of the Bible say, because of the ambiguity in Isaiah's terminology, that this does not necessarily mean a miraculous event. You getting the debate there? Is that making sense? So this is used as attack. I'm saying when you do a word study in this, you find out that every place it's used elsewhere in the New Testament, it normally is in the context of what we think of as a virgin, and thus it's referring to physically a virgin. All right, so the bigger challenge is the next one. So this first challenge, I'm saying, this doesn't do anything to stop how Matthew uses this prophecy. Yeah.
The immediate context here is strange. Why would God give you a sign of something that's completely normal?
We're going to get to that. If you just say it's just a normal thing, you know, lots of men and women who are virgins get married, come together, have children. That's not miraculous. Okay, it feels like there should be a miracle here. Otherwise, it's not a sign. I'm going to note how they address it, but I don't think it works grammatically. So how can this prophecy be fulfilled by Jesus? It's an excellent observation. You are on very much the right track. So how can this prophecy be fulfilled with Jesus? Well, first of all, note verses 14 through 16. Therefore, the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Curds and honey he shall eat, that he may know to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the child shall know to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. Now notice the language there seems to anchor the birth of this child during the timeline of Ahaz. You seeing that? So if verse 16 is during the time of Ahaz, and it's referring to the prophetic sign in verse 14, then in what way does that actually apply to Jesus? So here it appears that this promised virgin would have a child, and that he could eat solids and be able to discern right from wrong. This appears to be during the time of Ahaz, or to occur during the time of Ahaz. Now, there's a debate as to whether this speaks of a young child, like 2, 3, 4 years old, or the age of 12 when a son was considered to leave adolescence. Both of them fit the timeline of Isaiah and Ahaz. In other words, the child would be 2, 3, and 4, you can read it as prophetically fulfilled, or 12, you can read it as prophetically fulfilled in his timeline. But in either case, how does it apply to Jesus? And there are three major answers to that. The first say that this was only historically fulfilled. Some say that this was only historically fulfilled. In other words, this has nothing to do with Jesus at all. This is very much a liberal authority of the Bible denying view. If you hold to this view, it denies the clear teaching of the Bible as a whole, as it would reject what Matthew 1:23 says about the virgin birth. So that's how some people look at this. Well, it was just historically fulfilled. Matthew was just being creative, or he didn't understand it, and he applied it to, he made the whole thing up about the angel. That's just a figurative story and all of that. That's how they would say that. And they would say, well, you say, well, that's not what Matthew says. Well, you know, they don't believe, those kind of people don't believe in the inspiration of Scripture. They don't believe in the authority of the Scripture the same way we do. So those just thoughts just flow out logically from their standpoint. Second, there are some who say that this prophecy is strictly future. Strictly future. And that is future for Jesus. And that they would even say that the prophecy of verses 15 through 16 refers to Jesus in the future. That ultimately it's speaking of a fulfillment of this prophecy and deliverance of the Syrians from the land of Israel in the long term. And third, some would argue for a dual fulfillment. And here they would talk about an initial fulfillment after a child was born, but that there was a fuller or greater fulfillment when Jesus was born. In this sense, we're not talking about a partial fulfillment and then the whole thing later. Rather, it has two fulfillments, one that is a type or a foreshadow of a greater fulfillment. Now, let me just really quickly unpack the difference between partial fulfillment and the type or foreshadowing idea of dual fulfillment. A few weeks ago, I was talking about in 2 Samuel 7 about the promise that God makes to David about his throne being established forever and ever. And I noted that there were a number of promises made to David in 2 Samuel 7, some of which have already been fulfilled, some of which we are still waiting to be fulfilled. And I gave an analogy, and I talked about what if I told my family that we're going to go to New York City, and we're going to visit, we're going to go to New York City, we're going to eat New York-style pizza, and we're going to see the Statue of Liberty, okay? And I talked about how you could actually have those four things take place over time, that maybe one day we transferred planes in New York City. So we've been to New York, and we've been to New York City, and maybe another day we actually went there, and we had a chance to leave the airport and go get some New York-style pizza. And then finally, a couple of years later, we took a trip and we went to New York. And one of the things we did is we visited the Statue of Liberty. Right? That would be, my promise would be fulfilled over time. Dual fulfillment says, no, there's actually two different reference to the prophecy. There is an initial fulfillment that fully fulfills it in this time period. And then there's a second fuller fulfillment in the future. So it's not partial, it's dual. Okay? So these are the three major ways people have come to this text to try to answer how do we make sense of this? How is it that it appears to be in Isaiah and Ahaz's timeline fulfilled, but also Matthew applies it to Jesus? So I suggest actually that all three of these views have problems. The first clearly being heretical. But what I'm suggesting here is a modification of the second view. And the modification is that there is one prophecy that has two parts to it. Those parts would be that verse 14 refers only to the future, and verses 15 through 16 is a promise of what would happen if the child were born in Ahaz's lifetime. But it's only if the child were born, if he was to be born within these short years, the kingdoms that Ahaz feared would be overthrown. All right, now how in the world do I come to that conclusion? And I just want to say at this point, I was greatly helped a number of years ago by a now retired pastor and professor at Detroit Seminary. He wrote a great article on this. You can find it online on Detroit Seminary's website about this specific issue. His name was Bruce Compton, is Bruce Compton. He's of a great, great help to me in this. I've shook his hand once. When I say great help, I've read his stuff, all right? That's what I mean by that, all right? And so I'm borrowing from him here. It was really helpful to me. So how do we get there? So I'm saying that verse 14 refers only to the future, specifically Jesus. Verses 15 through 16 is a promise of what would happen if the child were born in Ahaz's lifetime. So, note that verse 14 seems to be a miracle. This is exactly what Todd was pointing out. If it is not a miracle, it just doesn't make sense in this context. Children are born all the time from women who are virgins, they have relations, and then a child is born. The sign or the miracle under this view, if you say it's not a miracle, the sign or the miracle would have to be that the nations that were a threat to Ahaz were destroyed. The child would only be a time stamp on when that promise would be fulfilled. But I don't think this really makes sense of the language here. It doesn't really flow out of that. It seems to be a miracle, verse 14. Furthermore, even just the phrase, God with us, you know, that could just be that the presence of God is with us. The whole thing seems to feel much more than just, you know, a child was born the other day in the normal way, right? So it doesn't seem to fit that. All right, number two, and yes, that was a reference to the song, but I misquoted it slightly, all right? My dad used to sing that to me. All right, You'd be embarrassed that I just said that publicly, but... All right, number two, there is a shift in pronouns that seems to be significant. Remember those wonderful grammar lessons? He, she, it, they, them, you know, that, which, all of those pronouns. And here we're talking about personal pronouns. There's a shift in pronouns. And we don't see this in English because our pronouns in English are not as precise as Hebrew pronouns. In verses 13 and 14, they address a group. They are plural pronouns. So Isaiah said, "Hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you, plural, to weary men, that you, plural, weary my God also? Therefore, the Lord himself will give you, plural, a sign." Now, the problem is in English, the pronoun you can be either singular or plural. So I can talk about you all are a wonderful Sunday school class. Debatable, but no, right? I say you collectively, right? You all are a wonderful, you know, Sunday school class. But I could say you, Ryan, are just paying attention so well. All right, I think that's true, but, you know, now he is. All right, we know that, all right, okay? And there I would be talking about the singular person. Okay, so, but in Hebrew, those pronouns are actually very specific. They have specific forms that would indicate whether it's singular or plural. In verses 13 and 14, they are plural. And in fact, you can already get the sense of that when it says, "O house of David." It's speaking to the household of David, talking about the Davidic line, which would represent the nation as a whole in some sense. But then there's a shift in verses 15 to 16. It's a shift from the plural to the singular. And I don't mean, "And he shall eat curds and honey," that is singular, "when he knows," singular, "how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good," verse 16, "the land whose two kings you," singular, "who you dread will be deserted." Okay, so that's a singular pronoun, not a plural. And this seems to indicate, at least, that it's possible that there is a switch in subject here. Now, I think that the best way to understand this switch is that Isaiah is relating this prophecy as a vision. Isaiah sees in this vision that a virgin would conceive and bear a son. Isaiah is not given a timeline on when that son will be born. And in fact, if you notice, he does not offer a timeline. But were he born immediately, Ahaz would find that his military problems would be gone by the time the child would reach the age where he could discern the good from the bad. Now, this is a very technical, tight, grammatical argument that I'm making here. So this is a little deeper than we normally go in Sunday school. So in other words, God is saying, "You could have asked me a sign. You didn't. I will give you a sign. I'm not going to tell you when that sign will come to pass. And the sign is that will demonstrate that your kingdom, the throne of David, will continue whether you yourself will be established or not. But were you to have received that sign in your lifetime, your deliverance would have been confirmed, but you did not ask for a sign, and so in time, your time, you will be judged." That's the message of Isaiah 7 and 8. So therefore, the prophecy was fulfilled in the future through the virgin birth of Jesus. But from the time that Isaiah received the prophecy until the deliverance of Ahaz was, depending on how you take the discerning of good and evil, 2 to 12 years. So there's not a dual fulfillment. It is a singular prophecy that has two parts. Now, this is a minority view. Probably today, most broad evangelical and by this, I mean usually faithful Bible teachers are probably going to argue for the dual fulfillment thing here. They're going to say that there was a near-term fulfillment and a far-term fulfillment. I have problems with that because I think it starts to mess with what we mean by prophecy, and you can start to really get a lot of questions about how you use the interpretation of the Bible. I think it has problems elsewhere, but you can still be a faithful Christian and hold to that view. What you can't be a faithful Christian is hold a view, number one, that said it was just historically fulfilled, that has nothing to do with the future. Matthew misused or misapplied the idea of the virgin birth. So two parts to a singular prophecy. One was seen from the timeline of Ahaz in his lifetime, and the other looking forward eventually, and Isaiah didn't know when, to the fact that there would be a virgin who would conceive and bear a son. All right, that was really technical, I know, in a busy time of the year, but this is a problem that comes up as people study this text. Questions on this?
Yes. I have a question. So when did that start getting into the Lutheran Church, that
belief? So the question is, when did that start getting in the Lutheran Church? I don't know that I can give you a definitive timeline on the Lutherans. I can tell you that, you know, as you think about the arc of the Reformation, think late 1500s till now, you get into the Enlightenment period, late 1700s, early 1800s. In general, the doctrine of the virgin birth starts to get questioned among some people in the European continent during that time period. And I do know by the time you get to the mid-1800s, there are a whole slew of people in Germany, which would be primarily Lutheran, who are denying or questioning the virgin birth. It's so much so that by the time you get to the early 1900s in the United States, this becomes one of the huge divides between what we were called at that time the modernists and the fundamentalists. So the fundamentalists said that, no, you have to believe in the virgin birth in order to really understand the gospel. And modernists were questioning not only the virgin birth, but all sorts of other miracles. They were coming from a very rational, skeptical mindset when it comes to the Bible. So specifically in the Lutheran Church, I think you're talking most assuredly there's at least that present in the mid-1800s. But that, whether that was here or not in America, I don't know at that time period. Part of that gets into, you have post-Civil War, huge numbers of American pastors go over to Germany to receive theological education. And they come back with them a lot of liberal ideas. I'm talking about theologically liberal ones. And one of them is this. So I could wax eloquent a long time beyond that, but I can't give a specific time period. But does that help at least answer the question? Yeah. It's been around for a while. In all the mainline denominations, when I say mainline, you think most of the major Lutheran, Methodist, some Baptist, Presbyterian. By the 1920s and 30s, this was a hot-button issue that resulted in splits in all of them. Major splits.
Well, and growing up Lutheran, that was never brought up. You know, the churches I went to. Now, one of them that I used to go to, I could probably see that that might be a little more prevalent.
Part of the problem is, and I alluded to this early, is that you have a number of people who will quote creeds that use language that we would agree with, but they either don't believe it or redefine it. So remember I said earlier on when I quoted from that ELCA article that we're not making, what was it, a gynecological assertion or whatever the language was there? Okay, that's jamming big words to try to confuse people to say, we don't believe it happened. So we'll use the phrase, but we don't. So we'll quote the creed, the Nicene and the Apostles' Creed, but we don't actually believe it. So broader even than that, early 1900s, there were two responses to that among conservatives, and we still see them today. One was to say we need to actually have doctrinal statements that define all of these terms and force people to reckon with them. A second response to that was to say, creeds aren't really worth much, which is where some evangelical traditions have gone to. That I'm not a fan of. I think creeds are good. You just need to make sure we're clear in what they say. They're helpful tools. Yeah.
Verse 17 here seems to give an indication that we've entered into a new epoch for Israel. That was a very dark time from the time of Isaiah to the birth of Jesus Christ. It was a very dark time for Israel. A time of disunity, no government, basically. They just abide in their territory. And then they're afflicted from without and all over the place. And what's interesting, he said, now I'm going to bring upon you a day, days that you've never seen before, basically, from the time Ephraim left Israel, left Judah, excuse me. So everything they come to know up to that point is now going to change for a period of time. And this virgin birth's going to come in that period of time, at the end of this, at that time.
That's a good it's a good observation. I need to think through that, but my inclination would be to say, yeah, that would make sense. Now, specifically, he does date that Ephraim is going to be no more in 65 years, right? Where does he say that? We read that earlier. Remember that Ahaz's son, I'm trying to get my timeline right, Ahaz's son is Hezekiah. Am I right on that? Who has a reform movement within Israel. So there is a break that happens from the heat that comes upon, or Judah specifically. But yeah, things from Ahaz onward are just on the whole. You get kind of like maybe a little of this, and then it just keeps going down, a little of this, and keeps going down. All right, I need to be done. So good questions, and I hope it stimulate your mind a little bit. Great lessons in here about prophecy, but also the Lord's promise to fulfill his word. Thanks so much. We'll get ready for our morning worship service.